Are you still buying your meat from the supermarket? If so, you simply don't know what you're getting. Was the animal treated ethically? Was it fed contaminated grain? Was it chemically treated just before processing? If you care about your health and that of the animal, you'll want to know the answers to these questions. Thankfully, buying directly from the farmer solves for all these problems. Jake and Anne Walkie run Walkie Farms, a regenerative operation in Albury, New South Wales, raising beef, lamb, pastured pork, and eggs to the highest standards of animal welfare, land stewardship, and chemical-free practice. I am excited to partner with Walkie Farm to offer you 10% off the entire Walkie range, from delicious steaks to sausages, lamb racks, and even lard and tallow to replace your seed oils. All orders are packaged and shipped frozen to your door all around Australia. If you have a local farm, by all means, source from them. But if you lack easy access to regenerative produce, then Walkie Farms have you covered. Use code Dr. Max at the checkout. That's DRMAX for 10% off. Circadian health is a bedrock of optimal health. No matter your exercise routine or how clean your diet, if you disrespect your light environment, you will get sick. Cancer, diabetes, obesity, mental health disorders, autoimmune disease, thyroid problems are just some of the issues that can either be worsened or fixed with circadian choices. My 30-day circadian reset is a guided program to help you learn the basics of circadian health. For 30 days, we focus strictly on things like seeing every sunrise, spending as much time grounded as possible, taking sun breaks throughout the day, and blocking blue light and artificial light at night. When you join up, you'll get access to 4 hours of lessons on how to make key circadian changes, as well as weekly live Q&As. If this is something that you're interested in, then join up today because we start on June the 1st. And if you need some basic equipment, including blue light blocking glasses and circadian friendly lighting, then use my code Dr. Max on bondcharge.com to grab all of these products. Now, onto the show. Podcast. I have the pleasure of sitting down with Kelsey Dexter. Now, Kelsey is a practicing consultant endocrinologist currently working in Jackson, Tennessee, USA. And Kelsey came onto my radar as someone who, a doctor who is really applying the light and circadian practices to the subspecialty of endocrinology, which is very, very special and very, very interesting. So, Kelsey, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It is my great pleasure. I've learned so much from you and your guests over the last few years, and I'm honored to be here.
Great. Well, let's start with your individual story, because as an endocrinologist, I think you have such disproportionate power in terms of helping to educate patients, but like most of us, you had your own journey. So please share that with us.
Yeah, I'd love to. So I pretty much knew I wanted to be a physician from a tiny age, and my path led me directly there. I didn't take any breaks. But my goal in getting into medicine was always to help heal people, right? And when I got into medical school and sort of realized the burden of chronic disease and that we were being taught that drugs effectively, like we are glorified pharmacists when we come out of medical school in a lot of ways to manage chronic disease processes, it was really frustrating to me. I actually went to med school to be a dermatologist because I was very interested in skin and skin cancer. And I was a person who slathered myself in sunscreen and avoided the sun at all costs and told other people to do that for years and years. And I realized when I got into medical school that I wanted to have a bigger impact on metabolic health. And that led me through internal medicine and then endocrinology down the road. Metabolism was my main interest because we can see the root cause of disease in a lot of ways in this country, you know, related to metabolism and insulin resistance. So interestingly, like I've always also been interested in integrative health. So I, back when I was in residency, there weren't any functional programs that you didn't have to pay for yourself. But I did a few rotations in at the Osher Center at Vanderbilt and was trying to find a pathway into more of a bridge to like functional plus traditional medicine. I went to the University of Colorado to study endocrinology, and they have a huge obesity research center there. So that was part of my background. I was the research fellow of my year, but bench research did not really interest me that much. And I was actually working on a project in public health looking at community gardens and how they impact chronic disease parameters and people who are new gardeners, which was pretty interesting. But let's see, as far as how I ended up on the quantum health path, it was kind of a crazy thing. But if you believe in, you know, kind of following golden threads and signs, I was working every day in this centralized paradigm and just feeling the weight of the burden of disease and how little impact I was making on people's long-term vitality. And I was having chest pain every time I walked into the building because of this discordance and malalignment, right? And I went to the mountains and I was hiking through the mountains and I hear a word in my ear, agrimony, which I've never heard before in my mind's ear. And when I got to the car and I Googled it, I realized it was a plant. And then I do a quick Google search on that. And this blog post pops up describing a man who left his corporate job and now is sort of a professional wild man promoting regenerative health practices and things. I ended up 2 years later doing a program with him and learned all about ancestral diets and earth connection. And that was one step toward me realizing how much impact our disconnection from nature has on our vitality. So since then, I've done some herbalism training programs. I am a Reiki attuned practitioner. I have a pretty big tool belt aside from my Western, endocrinology training, but in the day to day, I interact with a lot of patients in a centralized paradigm. And I try to figure out how I can improve the trajectory of everyone's health. And usually, that relates back to foundational health practices and quantum practices. And it's so shocking to me because we're in this world where we talk about these things all the time, right? That it seems common sense that being in sunshine is good for you, or optimizing your sleep, or being in contact with the earth, grounding and gathering electrons. And the average person just doesn't get it, because when you see everyone around you living the same way, you never question that what you're doing is hurting you. And I tell patients all the time that modern life sucks our vitality, right, in a lot of ways. And if you are sick, you have to focus on foundational health practices to begin to heal. And that has nothing to do with Western medicine. So, yeah, I have been. I've been sort of pushing light as therapy for a couple of years now, in my patients. And the thing to note is people don't come to me to talk about quantum and foundational health practices. They come to me because they're sick and they're on medicine and they want medicine management primarily. So, it's a really interesting dynamic when I try to fit this into every office visit and do educating, and many patients don't want that, you know, so it can be a little bit tough. But I see patients all the time that think they have hormone problems, right? And they want hormone testing. And that can range from, you know, I'm tired all the time, I can't lose weight, no matter what I do, or I have irregular periods, or, you know, transition through menopause, et cetera. And I can do labs on that person and know that they're all going to show up as normal, right? So there is relative hormone dysfunction just in the average American because of metabolic issues. And we know that 93% of Americans have metabolic dysfunction, meaning, you know, we can't efficiently switch between fuel sources. We're not fat adapted, relative mitochondrial dysfunction. And that plays a part in pretty much every disease process that affects Americans today. So I really try to think about what kind of actionable steps we can engage to move the needle slowly but surely in patients that don't seem overwhelming. One of the biggest battles I have is liquid sugar, of course, because, you know, Southern sweet tea and soda consumption can be staggering. So that's one of my general first rules is every patient that I see, I ask them to stop all liquid sugar. And we talk about time-restricted eating, circadian meal timing, and then we talk about light. And those are the three first steps to getting someone on a healthier path that I generally kind of dip into. But I kind of see dysregulated cortisol too, and the average American living with this sympathetic activation that's chronic as a big problem when it comes to trying to improve metabolism, since cortisol makes us insulin resistant too, right? And we need cortisol to live. We need it for, facing stressful events. But when it predominates because we don't sleep well, we're exposed to too much blue light and don't have good coping mechanisms, et cetera, you have this imbalance of cortisol in relation to melatonin. So too much activation, not enough rest and repair. So we talk about that a lot in my office as well. Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. And the setting or the role that we're practicing in, I mean, it's a big influence on how we eventually change or adopt different practices. And it sounds like working in where you are in Tennessee, and you mentioned before we started that this is the land of the 400 pound patient. And it sounded like you saw the worst of the worst, so to speak. And that was one of the prompts to change your approach. And it sounds what you're recommending in terms of those foundational health practices of time-restricted eating, light regulation, and eliminating liquid sugar and refined foods. I mean, that's exactly what I teach in my circadian reset course. And I think that just is so, so, so important. But describe, paint a picture for us, for the listeners, about the environment and about the people in your area, in your local area. What are the factors? Obviously, we've mentioned the liquid sugar, but why and how have they gotten to be so metabolically sick?
Yeah, I really think that primarily this has to do with diet culture, primarily. And I really believe it's dietary fructose because it's just so much higher in our population whenever you're drinking sugar. It just is. So one of the issues is when a patient's diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, okay, the manifestations of, that's the worst manifestation of insulin resistance, right? So in the past, our medicine options, our options of treatment are, we decrease the glucose load that's going into the body so that, you know, the pancreas can take care of the amount of glucose that's coming in. You can decrease the excretion of glucose through certain pathways using medications. And then you can improve insulin sensitivity with building muscle by taking, you know, metformin or a GLP-1 agonist It decreases the burden on the pancreas, and then you can give insulin and overcome the resistance, right? So a lot of, you know, I work in this medicine paradigm, and those are tools in my tool belt. And so I have been using all of these medicines to try to treat type 2 diabetes for my entire career. And older physicians, not just older, but like less, these primary care doctors that have been working in my area, in these rural areas, aren't as familiar with new treatment guidelines and new medications that are not insulin. So the worst manifestation of this that I see, the patient that's 500 pounds typically has been diagnosed with diabetes, put on metformin. It was not sufficient. Nobody ever talked to that patient about diet, exercise, restricted windows, anything. And then the next step was insulin, right? So when you give someone who is already insulin resistant more insulin, and well, insulin's a storage hormone. It's an energy storage hormone, and it prevents the body from being able to break down fat stores for fuel. So you see weight trend up over time in nearly every insulin treated patient, and that makes the patient more resistant to insulin. So as the dose of insulin goes up and the weight trends up, metabolic dysfunction gets worse and worse and worse. So whenever I am working with patients with type 2 diabetes, my main goal is to use the smallest amount of medicine possible. In the end, that's where we're headed. So sometimes I have to use medicine as a bridge to get there also, which I have seen in some individuals to be life-changing. And as an example, you know, if I have a patient who is morbidly obese and on hundreds of units of insulin a day, that patient will not lose weight with dietary intervention. I am a big fan of metabolic resets from a diet standpoint. But if a person who's taking all this exogenous insulin doesn't cut carbs down to nothing, they're still going to stimulate their body's need for insulin, and it just, metabolic dysfunction never improves. So the average person that I interact with is not going to do that anyway. Even if I tell them that this is a path to no medicine, I have to meet an individual where they are. And what is your best effort? How much can you do from a behavior standpoint? Can I make up the difference with medication to help you achieve goals and help us get your blood sugar down, which can help, you know, you avoid long-term complications. So yeah, that's kind of my general strategy.
Yeah. I mean, I've had this experience too, which is raising lifestyle changes with people who perhaps didn't come to you for specific lifestyle advice. And my experience has been that some people will be interested, some people won't be interested. Often you can't tell who was interested, and an offhand comment that made, you know, at the end of the consult might be enough to stimulate a massive change on someone. And then spending 20 minutes with another person, and they sound bought in and they're smiling and nodding, yet they make no changes. So what's the receptiveness of these messages around light, around food, and obviously you're encouraging to eat a lot of meat if you're encouraging basically zero carb or ketogenic diet. So mm-hmm. so tell me how that's received by your patients.
Most of my patients, when they've had any doctor talk to them about diet, have, you know, heard the common narrative, don't eat red meat, don't eat eggs, don't eat butter. And so whenever they say, oh, you're going to want me to eat healthy, so I'm going to eat more salads, right? That's what they all say. I've been eating lots of salads, Dr. Dexter. Well, so I have to do a little bit of education around like what's nutrient dense and what's appropriate and how our body handles nutrients, et cetera. And I think the average person is really surprised that I recommend that they start eating more red meat, eggs, and butter, right? I fight against the recommendations of some of their other providers, because nearly all of my patients, you know, they who have diabetes have a cardiologist too, who's giving them a completely different story. I would say that most people I interact with end up commenting, even if they didn't come for any kind of behavioral recommendations, that they learned something. They always learn something when they come to see me. And yeah, I have seen many, many patients make great shifts in their overall health over the last, you know, 10 years of working in this field by changing their diets. And then occasionally, you know, I have a patient I've seen for 5 years and I give them the same advice every time they come in. And then one day they decide to take it. And it took me 5 years to get them there. And I walk that road with a lot of folks, and this doctor-patient relationship, we're a team, and I just keep trying and meeting people where they are and doing the best I can to let them know how much power they have in their own health. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And it is, it's a partnership, and some people might not just have the bandwidth or space in their life to make radical changes, but yes, it's a progressive thing that we can help with over time. Talk to how you think about the relative contribution of light and food to metabolic dysfunction, because I liked how you mentioned that 93% of Americans have one marker of metabolic dysfunction, and that is something that I talk about as well, which is we shouldn't be waiting for a frank diagnosis of type 2 diabetes, but we actually shouldn't be waiting for a frank diagnosis of metabolic syndrome, which is obviously the five markers, waist circumference, triglycerides, HDL, fasting, blood glucose, and blood pressure. We shouldn't be waiting for someone to fulfill one of those criteria, let alone you know, getting all the way to metabolic syndrome, let alone getting all the way to type 2 diabetes. So talk about this relative metabolic mitochondrial dysfunction and how you think about maybe what is contributing. Obviously, we talked about the liquid sugar, but kind of beyond that.
It's definitely a multifactorial issue, right? What I think is interesting in the grand scope of things is our ancestors were outside all the time. Right. So the light environment wasn't an issue, but they were also looking for food to support survival. So more likely to be hungry than fed. Right. And the choice of food was limited to what was available or able to be killed or caught or gathered. And now we live in an environment where nutritional energy is abundant. Right. And we can eat essentially any food that we can think of. I mean, maybe there's some nuance with that in regard to like food deserts and transportation and accessibility in certain populations. And we could talk about that too. But now we are trying to figure out how we can limit the excess, right? What do I think about whether diet or light plays a bigger part, what relative part? I do know that the rate of obesity and metabolic dysfunction is progressively getting worse and worse, and it's really skyrocketed in the last 15 years. And I think about when I was young and I grew up in this area too, you know, the rate of childhood obesity and the incidence of type 2 diabetes in children was very low. And we still had sweet tea and soda and Pop-Tarts, and the diet was effectively the same. Some would argue that, you know, over the years, high fructose corn syrup has sort of infiltrated all processed foods to a greater degree. And there are people that think about how they can make this particular processed food more addictive, right, by changing the sugar and salt content. So a lot of that goes on in the background, and that kind of gets worse when it comes to processed food adulteration of fructose. But what really shifted about 15 years ago was our light environment. And, you know, we've moved from incandescent light bulbs, which emit red and infrared light, to LED lights that are mostly blue light emitting in our homes. Our screens have all shifted to LED, which is blue light. And then every person has a device in their face all day long, shining blue light into their eyes. And, you know, I go out and see kids all the time on tablets in restaurants while they're eating. You know, I think Dr. Cruz posted a study looking at bumblebees and feeding bees under red light versus blue light, and the prandial glucose excursion being about 50% higher. And, you know, we know the mechanism by which blue light increases blood sugar and increases insulin by CLIP, right? So I know that this is a big part of what's going on in chronic disease. And also, you know, hormones, all hormones, chemical messengers in the body have a circadian drive. They all do. Every cell pretty much does, right? And whenever we alter our light environment and we're crushing our melatonin release when we should be resting, sleep gets disrupted, and that dysregulates all hormones downstream. So cortisol in particular has it's very circadian driven with this diurnal release, and it's very easy to dysregulate cortisol, and dysregulating sleep on its own will dysregulate cortisol, which increases insulin resistance. And then whenever you add blue light's independent mechanism to increase insulin by CLIP, it's just a tangled web overall. I really think that your food diet and your light diet are probably equally important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that, Kelsey, because you are, I said this before, you're probably the world's first decentralized endocrinologist who is actively talking about the effect of light on metabolism and metabolic disease. And yeah, no one, as far as I've talked about in terms of endocrinologists, are really acknowledging this. And we're really two steps removed from the standard of care here, because, and obviously the standard of care is not even advising patients earnestly of these dietary changes, like getting rid of processed foods. It's this base layer is simply, you know, here's the insulin prescription, here's your GLP-1 agonist prescription, here's your metformin prescription, you know, go off, do your thing. That the next level is the metabolic focused doctors, the low carb, carnivore practitioners who are doing fantastic work, looking at this at a food-centric point of view, again, having fantastic results, still helping to reverse chronic disease, get people off insulin, reverse their diabetes. But really, that I don't think they're getting the whole picture here. And the metabolic story, as you've just alluded to, is so much a circadian story, because all those metabolic hormones, leptin, even insulin itself, insulin sensitivity has a diurnal circadian influenced secretion and effect. The fact is that we really, in my opinion, and your opinion too, we need to really encourage and recognize the role of light in affecting glucose sensitivity, blood glucose levels, insulin sensitivity, and all this. And the paper that I think you might be, there was another paper that was actually published in January, and they used red light. They had I'll quickly read out their the results. They found that 15-minute exposure to 670 nanometer light, so that's in the visible red range, reduced the degree of blood glucose elevation following glucose intake by 27.7%, integrated over 2 hours after the glucose challenge. And maximum glucose spiking was reduced by 7. So what they said is that photobiomodulation with 670 nanometer light can be used to reduce blood glucose spikes following meals. So that is the evidence, I think, that provides so much great evidence that it's the light environment is essentially modulating the effect of food on our blood glucose. Maybe talk now a bit about the kind of approach that you have to someone with metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance, particularly with regard to leptin, because a lot of people have talked about leptin and how that can make, basically leptin resistance can influence our ability to lose weight. So do you measure leptin in your practice, or do you talk about leptin to your patients, and how do you think about leptin in this picture?
Well, the vast majority of people I see, I know, are leptin resistant, right? Because leptin resistant pretty much precedes insulin resistance or accompanies it at the very least. And I talk to a lot of patients about leptin. My lab actually has no option to measure leptin, which is insane. to me. So I am not accustomed to actually looking at objective levels. I just make an assumption that dysregulation is an issue. And usually, you know, I'm talking to women who say my periods are irregular, I can't lose weight, I'm barely eating anything, I'm tired, help me, and I think leptin, right? And regulating leptin really has so much to do with circadian health. Less to do maybe with the diet, more to do with the light, or you can't have one without the other to get it regulated. So I encourage every patient who comes in with that sort of constellation of complaints to work on their light first. This is what we always talk about. I think actually when patients find working on their light environment to be less intimidating than working on their food. And so I really like to get the light environment right before I try to talk a patient into a very low carb ketogenic diet. And both at the same time can be a little bit overwhelming. But in the average patient who's working on leptin sensitivity with me, I encourage them to, you know, see the sunrise with naked eyes every day and start that circadian signal to improve their melatonin production and secretion. And then get a protein rich, effectively keto breakfast within an hour of waking up to send that meal timing, safety, satiety signal to the brain, blocking artificial light at night, not just blue light, but trying to, I talk to every patient about strategies to decrease their blue light toxicity. And that's sort of the first bridge overall that we cross. I really believe as far as low carb diets, you know, the average person that I deal with pretty profound insulin resistance, if I ask that person to go straight to carnivore, the body's not fat adapted. Right. So as glucose in the bloodstream starts to fall with that low carb diet, the brain is going to get a signal that the patient needs to eat carbs. And because that pathway to flip fuel sources has not really been triggered in maybe decades, the blood sugar tends to get pretty low in patients who are on low carb diets. And whenever glycogen stores are released and glycogen is expended and we get to the point where the body's asking for fuel, it's not really efficient at using ketones for fuel. And that person will feel awful, weak muscles, low sugar, shaking, sweating, and will give up after, you know, a few days. So I do think that diets have to be really individualized with patients. And one thing that bothers me a lot, just sort of in the health community, is all this nutritional dogma, right? So carnivores and plant-based folks fight out all the time about which is better and what's the optimal way to eat. And different bodies need different balances of macronutrients depending on health, disease, and goals. But in general, for metabolic dysfunction, I really don't believe anything works better than a low-carb diet for a metabolic reset. So I tend to take patients meal by meal into, like, slowly into ketosis after we work on their light. So we start with the high-protein, high-fat breakfast in leptin reset. And we might do that for a couple weeks and be really consistent with that behavior. And then we start working on lunch and cutting out the carbs at lunch. And then eventually less than 30 grams of carb a day is what I recommend to sort of as a dietary strategy to work on reprogramming metabolism. And I don't expect patients to eat very low carb long term. And I don't know that that's good for every person. I think our body has to be adept at using glucose for fuel and using ketones for fuel. You know, when you eat a long term ketogenic diet, the metabolism accommodates that and you can get relative insulin resistance. And when you have carbs, have really high glucose excursions if you've been in long term ketosis. So I do really like the idea of long term cycling of carbs. Yeah.
Yeah. That's something that I've thought myself, which is it is seasonally appropriate to be cycling in and out of a fat burning metabolism. And, you know, unless we're living in the Arctic Circle where there's only seal blubber and caribou available for food, then it doesn't make really much sense to be in that burning mode the whole year round. So that is a nuance that I like to make. And especially that allowance is permitted when people have healed their metabolic dysfunction and sure. when they've got all those markers under control. What in terms of, I also really like your approach of gradually introducing or reducing the carb amount. And I imagine for the patients that you work with, that is definitely necessary. Tell us about helping people come off these heroic doses of insulin, because, and my approach too, which I think maybe Dr. Bernstein kind of pioneered in his treatment or recommendation for type 1 diabetics, is trying to be using the minimum amount of insulin necessary. Obviously, they don't have a working pancreatic islet cells, but in type 2 diabetics who are on massive amounts of insulin, how do you think about getting them off what is essentially quite a dangerous drug and medication?
Oh, yeah. Well, I talk to every patient about the fact that the more insulin it takes to control your blood sugar, the higher your risk of chronic disease, right? So we know it's not the blood sugar per se, it's the insulin level, insulin resistance that's associated with the diseases that kill Americans, type 2 diabetes and complications, cardiovascular disease and complications, Alzheimer's and cancer. And so when I lay that out to a patient and say, hey, you're on, you know, 200 units of insulin a day, I need to get this down to the lowest amount possible, and can you help me? I can motivate some pretty significant behavioral shifts. But like I alluded to before, I do often use insulin sensitizing drugs in this case to decrease the burden of insulin, because if I can get the insulin level down, the patient can start to lose weight independent of the effect, the weight loss effect of a GLP-1 agonist like Ozempic or Mounjaro, right? So if a patient starts to lose weight and insulin sensitivity improves, I can just progressively drop the insulin. And the goal in the end, as long as the pancreas is still making some insulin enough to manage glucose levels at baseline, then we try to come off of all insulin or medicines that increase insulin, because that provides the best long-term health benefit for that patient. And that's the way you reverse metabolic disease, right?
Love it.
I have had, and in regard to type 1, okay, I think in the past, you know, patients who have type 1 diabetes don't make insulin from their beta cells. So we have to have insulin to survive. And insulin has gone through many iterations and evolution in the last few years. And it's been a really exciting time to be in endocrinology, because our options for treating type 1 diabetes have broadened so much. In the past, if a person was insulin deficient, they would be on, you know, a long-acting insulin for basal coverage that works either 6 hours, 8 hours, 10 hours. And then over the years, these long-acting insulins have improved so that you give one injection and you get a 24-hour coverage of needs. But what we do on injection therapy is we try to estimate the best median need of insulin, right? So when you have a fixed dose of basal insulin in a patient who is dynamically using glucose, there are going to be days when that dose is perfect, optimal, days when they've been more active, eaten less, different cycle time for women, et cetera, when it's going to be a little bit too much. And then there are going to be days when they're stressed, sick, not moving, whatever, where that basal need is going to be higher. So in general, there's been a tendency to cover mealtime insulin needs with a basal insulin in the background. Even in patients who have type 1, doctors tend to slightly overshoot the basal dose requirement to try to prevent the blood sugar from going too high when a patient eats. And that causes a patient to have to eat to maintain their maintain normal blood sugars. And the higher the insulin dose in the background, the more likely a person is to gain weight, since insulin inhibits lipolysis. Lipolysis. And so in many patients with type 1 diabetes, when they're started on insulin therapy, they immediately start to gain weight. And the more weight that's gained, the more insulin resistance, and they don't have the option really to suppress insulin, which is what's required to burn fat stores, right? Because they have this constant injected dose that's the same all the time. Patients with type 1 are also taught to be scared of ketosis because we have a life-threatening complication of DKA. So patients try really hard to avoid ketones in general whenever they have type 1 diabetes. And when you eat to support your insulin dose, you're consistently gaining weight and you're never in ketosis, that creates metabolic disease. So I'm really, really excited about the landscape of type 1 diabetes treatment now, because, you know, as far as insulin delivery, our gold standard is hybrid closed loop insulin pumps. And whenever you have a glucose monitor that can communicate with an insulin delivery device, you can program that system to turn off whenever glucose levels fall. So for the first time, patients who have type 1 diabetes have this option to only get insulin when they need it, right? And that opens up this pathway to improve metabolic health dramatically in that population. And, you know, I've got, I argue with insurance companies about this all the time, but I really believe that type 1 and type 2 diabetes coexist frequently. I have patients who have known pancreatic islet destruction, are insulin deficient, have gained, you know, 150, 200 pounds over the years. And I know that if their pancreas were functional, it wouldn't be making 200 units of insulin a day. It wouldn't be able to. So they would effectively have type 2 diabetes if they had a functional pancreas based on their insulin requirement. And I have used medications like, GLP-1 agonists, like Ozempic and Mounjaro, in patients sort of off-label who have type 1 diabetes to decrease the insulin burden. And I've seen incredible improvements in metabolic health over time, which has been really rewarding. So, you know, I've got a patient I can think of offhand who was using about 250 units of insulin a day to control his blood sugar. And now he's down to 20 units a day and he's lost 100 pounds. And then once we restore metabolic health, I try to wean patients off of the GLP-1s. And usually if we have been working on light environment, diet, changing behavior, and they're educated and they know, like, the more insulin they need, the faster, like, this metabolic disease can come back. You know, they tend to do really, really well. So I've had many patients with type 1, you know, that are incredibly insulin resistant who have benefited from all of these practices as well. But we try really hard. Every patient that's taking insulin, I want them to take the least amount possible. Yeah.
Yeah. For long-term health. I love it, Kelsey. There's so much gold there that for what you just said, for family doctors and for other endocrinologists. And I want to summarize a little bit of it. And specifically around the nuance of these GLP-1 agonist drugs like Ozempic. And what I think is that it's a completely different kettle of fish for people who are sick. And the ones that we're talking about on a clinical point of view is not the same as the person who's trying to lose 5 kilos, has nothing wrong with them, and is, you know, using Ozempic to lose weight. That is that's completely a different story. And what I think you're really showing us is that these GLP-1 agonists can be used very judiciously to help people regain insulin sensitivity, and therefore bootstrap this whole process of resolving their metabolic disease and improving their metabolic disease, because it allows us to get that total insulin dose, exogenous insulin dose, down quicker. And as you said, for people who aren't aware, the larger the insulin dose, the more risk of a hypoglycemic event, the more risk of a hypoglycemic coma, and something very, very bad. So I really like that nuance there. And that's the reason why anyone who is taking medications really needs to see a metabolically trained doctor, because there's all these nuances around drug weaning that we have to go through to make sure that this whole process can happen safely. So that's a great point. The other point is that loop of carbohydrate consumption in those with type 1 diabetes. And this is something that you see not only in type 1 diabetics who have, remember, for the listener, an autoimmune destruction of their body's ability to make insulin. It's not only them, but it's also gestational diabetics. So late in pregnancy, we see people become quite insulin resistant, and women often get prescribed insulin to, again, maintain their blood glucose lower. But what we commonly see is that people get put on a high dose of carbs because they're on insulin. And there's this drug loop of glucose and insulin. They're both drugs that people are taking, a high insulin dose because they're eating carbs, and therefore it's a vicious cycle that escalates upwards and upwards.
It's just crazy, really.
And from thinking from first principles, I mean, I'm not an endocrinologist, but it's obvious to me that is not a winning strategy if we're trying to optimize people's health in the long term and maintain their insulin sensitivity, reduce their total lifetime insulin signaling in the body.
Yeah, I think this is sort of the old diabetes education framework, right? If you have a fixed dose of insulin that you're giving someone multiple times a day, you need a fixed amount of carb to be eaten with that insulin, or else you have low blood sugar. So I think that's kind of where it came from, right? This recommendation to eat I think it's like 50 grams of carb per meal, which is insane. That's what the average patient who's had diabetes education comes in and tells me. I said, well, I'm eating, 50 grams of carb a meal like I'm supposed to. But anyway, we just learn better, do better.
Yeah, it's my hobby horse, because I think so. There's so much harm being done by these high carb dietary recommendations for type 1 diabetics and gestational diabetics, when if they're eating a meat-based diet, a lot less carbohydrates, then the whole body's demand for exogenous insulin goes down, and the process is much more the body is healthier. I want to talk about a topic that you just alluded to, which is a disease called latent onset diabetes of adulthood, which is essentially this coexistence of both type 1 and type 2 diabetes, and it is something that we can see sometimes in someone who's perhaps gained weight, but they're essentially not only insulin resistant, but they become insulin deficient too. So talk about that and why it's a very important diagnosis for any doctors listening to consider when they have someone who is when they're perhaps making a new diagnosis of diabetes.
Yeah. So, in the past, we called type 1 diabetes juvenile diabetes because it tends to occur in kids. And there's a known autoimmune pathway that involves the destruction of beta cells that produce insulin that result in an insulin deficient state there. And then most often patients with type 2 diabetes get there through an insulin resistance pathway. So the pancreas can't make enough insulin to overcome the body's resistance, which causes blood sugars to rise. And so it's not a disorder of insulin deficiency. It's you need to improve insulin resistance to help the blood sugar come down. So completely different conditions. Then we know now that type 2 diabetes can occur in children, right? Because of severe insulin resistance that we see, which is likely, as we said, related to light environment in young kids. And we also know
the iPad and the Mountain Dew.
The iPad, yes, and the Mountain Dew at the same time. And then we know that autoimmune type 1 diabetes can occur in adults. And I don't really think about LADA, latent autoimmune diabetes of the adult, right, as being a type 2 variant. It's a type 1 variant. It's the average person I see that comes in with WADA has been treated as a type 2 by a primary care doctor for, you know, 5 or 10 years with an A1C of about 8 and on 4 different medicines for type 2 diabetes and isn't getting better. And so then I check that patient's endogenous insulin reserves and screen for type 1 antibodies, and they are not making much insulin. They're making some, but not much. And then they have positive antibodies. So I call that patient a LADA. But when you consider that the average American is insulin resistant already, right, you have these patients that end up with type 1 who still have maybe a little bit of insulin. And so it's this area where we're dealing, they're really two independent pathophysiologies that can coincide in any patient. And so the average person that I have with type 1 or LADA is also insulin resistant, and they can benefit from both types of therapies, you know, have to take insulin, but also have to work on the resistance pathways.
Yeah. And I think that the way I think about it, if there's been a sudden, relatively sudden, maybe over a year, kind of decline in blood glucose control or increase in the HbA1c, despite someone being pretty adherent to a good lifestyle, then that's my kind of prompt to check the C-peptide, check the islet autoantibodies to make sure that we're not also dealing with a concurrent insulin deficiency process, which would necessitate even a little bit of exogenous insulin. But that is really helpful. And I think it's important for doctors to think about, because, like you said, they're coexistence. And if we tie in the light environment and we're thinking about how dysfunctional people's light environment is, how vitamin D deficient they are. So we know that immune function is so intrinsically linked to our sunlight exposure and therefore our vitamin D levels, that not only this infectious disease susceptibility, but also autoimmune disease is going to be going hand in hand. So if the patient is, you know, guzzling the Mountain Dew and, you know, on the iPad in front of the TV for decades, and they're vitamin D deficient because they never go outside, it makes a lot of sense to me that they would be at risk of this autoimmune process in addition to their insulin resistance and process.
And yeah, so there's a quite an overlap in endocrinology and sort of, you know, autoimmune disease etiology of glandular diseases. So I think about this a lot too, because I have, you know, many patients with Hashimoto's and Graves' disease, which are autoimmune diseases of the thyroid, and then Addison's disease, which is autoimmune destruction of the adrenal glands. Autoimmune diseases in general are increasing pretty dramatically, and I really believe that our altered light environment has played a big part in that, and vitamin D deficiency, right? So I check vitamin D in every patient that I see, and unless a patient is actively supplementing consistently, they are going to be low every time. And I talk to patients a lot about the benefit of making your own D from cholesterol, right, in response to sunshine. And I view vitamin D deficiency as a surrogate marker of light deficiency, natural light deficiency. So I really don't like high dose prescription vitamin D supplements. I don't think that giving huge doses of once weekly vitamin D, which is really the only prescription version of vitamin D that's available. So that tends to be what physicians give patients. I don't think that that's probably the optimal way to replace severely deficient folks too. In the wintertime, you know, supporting vitamin D levels, if you didn't get your vitamin D level to a robust place by the end of the summer through sunlight exposure, is probably important. I really try to recommend that patients do daily D3 instead of weekly D2. So anyway, but I see some patients that, you know, I end up getting a lot of malabsorption syndromes that have low calcium, patients that have low calcium from either gastric bypass or they've had parathyroid surgery and now have chronically low calcium. And there is no way for me to supplement their D and get their level to a perfect place. It just cannot happen. And for those patients, we talk so much about UVB exposure and building a solar callus early in the springtime. And I have seen miraculous improvements in these malabsorptive low calcium patients who have actually taken this on and made a commitment to get intentional low intensity sun exposure.
It's so pivotal, this the light story, and tying it into endocrinology is this marker that we measure, 25 hydroxy vitamin D, is basically a proxy. That's how I think about it too. It's basically a rough proxy of the solar yield that patient has had. And deficiency, which is, in Australia, it's defined as essentially above or below 50 nanomoles per liter. But that kind of target was set to as avoiding any of the frank bone complications. That's mild deficiency, and then, more severe is under 30. And I know you guys use nanograms per deciliter. But when you look at the other roles that vitamin D plays in the body processes, especially to do with the immune system, getting it above 75 is much more reasonable, still too low in my opinion. And then if you look at these traditional hunter-gatherer peoples and outdoor workers, it looks like a natural vitamin D level is, hovering above 100, around 120 nanomoles per liter. So do you target any particular number, or what do you do in terms of aiming to get people's vitamin D to?
Oh, I would love to see vitamin D's over 80. But in general, my treatment goal is over 60. If we can get it there. Yeah. In our standard labs, we consider less than 30 to be deficient, but I think about 40 as being probably deficient too. And definitely not optimal. So I have so much overlap with other providers, and I, see lots of patients come on and off these high dose vitamin D supplements. They'll get their vitamin D replete to 35, and someone will stop their replacement in the middle of winter, and then they can't maintain it, etc. So, I pay a lot of attention to vitamin D, and like I said, we try to keep patients over 60 if possible, and get that through sun exposure when possible. Yeah,
yeah, and that's this solar callus concept too, which I think could be one of the most important facets of this whole lifestyle change that could potentially alleviate so much metabolic disease, as well as cardiovascular disease and cancer. And my interview with Richard Weller, which will be released by the time this goes out, his data has shown that people who have higher UV exposure are living longer, and they've got greater less cardiovascular mortality, less cancer mortality. So we're really kind of up against these skin cancer narratives when we're trying to encourage people to build a solar callus. But in terms of the weight of benefit and risk, I think it's undoubtedly clear that people need to be getting more progressive UVB and full spectrum sunlight exposure.
I recommend sun exposure to generally every patient that I see for these reasons, these myriad of benefits. And the number of patients that tell me that they cannot tolerate the sun and argue with me on this is significant. I'm allergic to the sun. I get rashes and hives in the sun. I can't sweat, so I can't go outside, etc. And my personal anecdote, okay, I was a big time sunscreen lover, like I said, my entire life. I had a reputation for being the palest person around, especially my family. And I always thought that I was sun sensitive, right? Because I had no innate protection, and I walked out in the sun in the middle of July and got burned in 5 seconds. So I thought I had fair skin and was sun sensitive. And then whenever I started, I had my own health issues that got me on this journey to, it really started with vitamin D and the sun in relationship to the benefit, to the neurologic system, right? So I decided I was going to be my own experiment. And I started a couple years ago in March with the DMinder app, outside in the mornings in the low intensity light. And by the time I got to summer with no sunscreen, I could, you know, lay out at solar noon for an hour and a half and not get a sunburn. And so I proved it to myself as a person who always thought she was sun sensitive. And I've since done the same thing with my kids, right? And people around me are sort of amazed at this. So I really believe that anyone can tolerate some sun, right? We are designed to be receptacles for sunlight. Like this is our physiology. It's all wrapped up in this light story, and every person can get some exposure safely. And we start with low intensity and let the skin be exposed to beneficial protective frequencies in the light spectrum, red light and infrared light, right, to help mitigate damage. And over time, there's clear benefit to everybody that tries it, I think.
Yeah, I agree, couldn't agree more. And it's a misconception that people with Fitzpatrick, even one skin, need to, you know, avoid the sun. And based on what we know about the benefits of sunlight for health, and as you mentioned, we are receptacles for sunlight, and our body has evolved these mechanisms to harness ultraviolet light through melanin, to harness infrared light through things like the cerebrospinal fluid and the work of Scott Zimmerman. So it's so key, and that's why I've released a solar callus course, so people can check that out if they want to get all the information they need to safely get sun exposure. Can you talk now about thyroid disease? Because, and particularly in the context of both insulin resistance and maybe, leptin resistance, because so often I see women who are having problems with their hormones, they're having problems with their of frequent snap or being hungry frequently, stubborn weight, they're pale, and they have some degree of thyroid dysfunction. So can you explain to us and the listener, how do you conceive about the thyroid within the context of the things that we've talked about?
So the average person that comes to me with that constellation of symptoms assumes that they have a thyroid problem, right? So the collective narrative is, if you're having trouble losing weight and you're tired all the time, it's probably your thyroid. And so I do a lot of just general thyroid screening to look for thyroid disease, primary thyroid disease. And for me, that's pretty extensive in my clinic. I think I probably do more testing than the average endocrinologist, and screening antibodies, thyroid antibodies in every person that comes in, and a full thyroid panel. And often in that patient, there is no thyroid dysfunction, or perhaps there is a very, like, the thyroid levels are slightly suboptimal, but still in the normal range. And then the question always is, you know, that patient has been reading, it says, information is everywhere. So patients come in very well informed and will say to me, you know, that TSH is not optimal, and why? And then we have to talk about the interface between leptin resistance, and how this has an impact on overall thyroid function. But the issue itself is not the primary thyroid dysfunction, it's leptin resistance, which is a really common issue. And so, you know, then again, we're talking about low carb diets and light diets in those patients. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. And it's become so simple often, but it's also a process of education and helping people understand that they need those light signals to essentially kick off the whole hypothalamic pituitary thyroid axis. And we need those morning light signals to get the party started from a thyroid point of view. Maybe because you're a consultant endocrinologist and this is kind of these couple more nuanced topics, can you talk about things like something like Addison's disease, or maybe some other more traditional endocrine pathology that you see that might be related to or contributed to by lifestyle and light?
So autoimmune disease is a little bit nebulous in general, right? Because Western medicine says we don't really know why immune systems turn on bodies. And there are a lot of theories that have to do with gut dysfunction, leaky gut, post-viral syndromes, etc. And I don't really know about a direct relationship in literature or understanding with light, environment, and autoimmune diseases. But there is, like you said, a direct impact of vitamin D deficiency on decreased immune function. And I'm not sure if that's the primary mechanism by which this interfaces, but it could be. I do think that because our light signaling has such a profound impact on every body system, if you are trying to heal autoimmune disease, you have to get your light right. And we know that there's a direct relationship between D deficiency and like multiple sclerosis, which is an autoimmune disease of the nervous system. And we just supporting the body on a foundational level involves getting these factors optimized, right? So we get our light environment right, we drink clean water, we eat healthy, nutrient-dense food that's relatively low carb. They're just like, it's part of the package to encourage healing in any kind of autoimmune disease, I think.
Yeah, yeah, no, agree with that totally. Maybe we could finish on a couple more kind of lifestyle practices or aspects that you think people could include to improve their blood glucose. And we've talked a lot about light. And I mentioned that study about the effect of red light, 670 nanometer, which is essentially you can get from the morning sunrise and the evening sunset. But we've obviously talked about a lower carb diet, but tell us how you think about things like cold, exercise, and maybe stress in terms of that blood glucose and maybe what people might even measure on something like a continuous glucose monitor.
Oh yeah. So I love objective measurements of blood sugar to try to help people determine how they can get better control of their glycemic health, and use this a lot. But I generally think about metabolic health as being this ability to bounce in and out of fat metabolism, right, easily. And cold thermogenesis, of course, when you have the ability to make heat in your brown fat from your fat stores, it improves insulin sensitivity. And I've done some experimentation with this on myself, where I put on a continuous glucose monitor and get in a cold plunge for 3 minutes, and I can see my blood sugar fall from, you know, 90 to 55 within just a short amount of cold therapy. So that's pretty exciting overall. And I talk to a lot of patients about getting cold air exposure, like just underdressing for the weather, because that's a good gateway into cold therapy for most people. And it's not very intimidating. And many, many patients are very receptive to that when we're talking about improving insulin sensitivity and helping metabolism. Our muscles hold our primary stored form of glucose, right? So muscles are the biggest source of glycogen that we have in our bodies. We hold about 500 grams of glycogen in muscles on average, and then about 80 in the liver. So whenever our blood sugar falls in fasting state, or we're using energy, glycogen is the first thing to be mobilized. And so the bigger reserve you have for holding glycogen, the less glucose will be shuttled into fat stores whenever you have a blood sugar rise. So improving muscle mass, increasing muscle tone and strength is a great strategy to improve insulin sensitivity. And I really think, you know, there are lots of health influencers that tell the general public that, you know, I eat rice 3 times a day and I'm metabolically flexible, and you can eat carbs and still lose weight, et cetera. And that completely has to do with how insulin resistant a person is, how much muscle mass they have, how much they move every day, right? So for the average person that I see who doesn't exercise or can't because of chronic pain or issues with very low muscle mass reserve and very low activity, that person is going to benefit from carb restriction, trying to get cold, and any amount of activity they can muster. But you have to lean more heavily into diet and light when you can't move and build muscle, right? And so it's a stepwise approach. You get a little bit healthier, you can move more, and then you can integrate eventually more carbs into your diet if you improve the metabolic issue and then are able to build some muscle, et cetera, and get healthier.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying. You read a post by guys like Carnivore Aurelius about, you know, eating carbs, croissants and orange juice and all this kind of thing. But really they're talking to that 7% of people who are metabolically healthy in society. Mm-hmm. And that advice is just completely inappropriate for someone who is spending 93% of their time indoors, on the Mountain Dew and, TV blue light diet. It's not appropriate, and it's not transferable in any way. Mm-hmm. I agree that we have to fix this underlying insulin resistance and metabolic dysfunction before you can earn back the right to eat things like seasonal carbs. The points that you made about the cold are very, very, very well taken. Great advice. And I interviewed Thomas Seeger, and I really encourage mm-hmm. people to check out my episode with that. And he noticed the same thing, that if he decided to eat a cake or something like this, he could simply pop in his cold plunge, his ice bath, and essentially suck the glucose out of the system. And that is the power of the brown fat and the cold mm-hmm. adaption. So, rather than chasing carbs with insulin, maybe we need to be chasing carbs with cold plunge, because that's a much better way of getting the glucose out of the system. The other point is this concept has actually got a diagnosis, which is sarcopenic obesity, which is the confluence of both a sarcopenia, so low muscle mass, and obesity. So that is something that we see in nursing homes so commonly, and which is that really bad combination of having very low muscle mass and being insulin resistant and metabolically sick. And, the antidote to that, I mean, I think sarcopenic obesity, the reason why people get it is because they're so profoundly disconnected from an ancestral lifestyle and basically mm-hmm. everything that we've talked about, in this past hour. Good thing to be aware of. And if you see someone they're sitting in their chair frozen, essentially in a nursing home, not moving, and all these endocrine systems are completely they're going wrong. They're leptin resistant, they're insulin resistant. So maybe just fixing it starts with doing everything we talked about, but particularly the light and the food, because you don't have to necessarily be physically active to start those two. Fantastic. Kelsey, did you have any other kind of thoughts that you wanted to share with everyone, maybe to colleagues? Because, we've talked a lot about some of the technical ins and outs of treating insulin resistance. Maybe you have some message from some medical or doctor colleagues who are listening.
I think primarily we have to understand that pharmaceutical medicine is not going to be the answer to heal metabolic issues. And we can't just lean on that toolbox. We have to get interested in physiology again, right? And how our body works. And I found that learning from other colleagues, being humble and open-minded is probably the most important part of growth, right? As a provider and a healer. And we don't know everything in Western medicine. There's so much we don't know. And I have learned and changed my mind and changed my approach on treatment options so much over the last 10 years. And we have to get back to foundational health practices and supporting vital functions in patients and letting the body heal itself, because it's very capable in many cases of restoring balance when the right inputs are received. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, Dr. Kelsey Dexter, thank you so much for talking to me. And I think your message is so well received. So how can people get in touch with you if they want to send you a message or have a chat or see you as a patient?
Well, I, see patients in Jackson, Tennessee and on telehealth. But I have a social media presence on Instagram. I am sort of active there, not really, but I'm open to getting any kind of messages through that platform too.
Cool. Great. All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening to the Regenerative Health Podcast. I hope this episode helped you better understand some aspect of improving your lifestyle for optimal health. If you enjoyed this episode, then share it out with friends and family. Leaving a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify podcasts also helps spread the message. Thank you and see you next time.